491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 335, recorded on November 29th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. This week, we're going to be talking about William B. Wilson, the first Labor Secretary of the United States. We actually talked about him in passing. I don't know if we mentioned his name or not, but a couple of weeks ago on our episode where we talked about the 1919 coal strike and the 1919 steel strike, we talked about William B. Wilson and that he was a pro-union labor secretary. But we didn't talk about the fact that he was the first labor secretary, and we didn't really talk a whole lot about his background and who he was. And he's a pretty interesting figure, so we wanted to take this week to talk about him more specifically. So William B. Wilson, not to be confused with Woodrow Wilson, who was the president that he served under, was born in 1862 in Scotland. His family was displaced to the United States during a coal strike there. His father had been involved in the coal mining industry. William B. Wilson himself became a union organizer in American Mines at age 12. From then on, went to eventually rise to become a top official, specifically Secretary Treasurer of the United Mine Workers of America, before the age of 40. Now, when he had started out in the mining industry and union organizing at age 12, he was what was known as a breaker boy. So, Rachel, could you talk to us a little bit about what a breaker boy was in the coal mining industry and why that was important for union politics?
Right. So up until about 1900, nearly all coal breaking facilities in the United States were labor intensive. So they had to remove the impurities from the coal by hand. And this was done usually by breaker boys between the ages of 8 and 12 years old. The use of breaker boys began around 1866. So for 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, breaker boys would sit on wooden seats perched over the chutes and conveyor belts, picking slate and other impurities out of the coal. Breaker boys working on top of chutes or conveyor belts would stop the coal by pushing their boots into the stream of fuel flowing beneath them, briefly pick out those impurities, and then let the coal pass on to the next breaker boy for further processing. Others would divert coal into a horizontal chute at which they sat, and then pick the coal clean before allowing the fuel to flow into, quote, clean coal bins. This work was very hazardous. They were forced to work without gloves so that they could better handle the slick coal. The slate, however, was sharp, as anyone who's handled slate would know, and breaker boys would often leave work with their fingers cut and bleeding. They also sometimes had their fingers amputated by the rapidly moving conveyor belts. Others lost feet, hands, arms, and legs as they moved among the machinery and became caught under conveyor belts or in gears. Many were crushed to death, their bodies retrieved from the gears of the machinery by supervisors only at the end of the working day. Others were caught in the rush of coal and crushed to death or smothered. Dry coal would kick up so much dust that breaker boys sometimes wore lamps on their heads to see, and asthma and black lung disease were common. Coal was often washed to remove impurities, which created sulfuric acid, and this acid burned the hands of the breaker boys. Breaker boys were known for their fierce independence and rejection of adult authority. They often formed and joined trade unions and precipitated a number of important strikes in the anthracite coal fields of Pennsylvania. Among these were the strike which culminated in the Latimer Massacre and the coal strike of 1902. William B. Wilson himself did try to organize a strike. He tried to launch a union for the boys who worked as trappers, who manually operated the ventilation of the mines. And when this fledgling union threatened a strike over a wage reduction, Union Representative Wilson discovered the limits of union solidarity. He got paddled by a foreman, and the strike was broken. So in his unpublished memoirs, he wrote, quote, "His argument had been forceful and effective, but it was applied to the wrong part of my anatomy to be permanently convincing. It helped impress upon my mind the fact that until working men were as strong, collectively, as their employers, they would be forced to accept whatever conditions were imposed on them." So this was the background that kind of led William B. Wilson to become the pro-labor person he became in his later years as labor secretary.
So William B. Wilson rose through the ranks of the coal mining union activist space in the late 19th century. And as we said, by the turn of the century, he was the international secretary treasurer of the United Mine Workers of America. But he was also elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1906, where he served for three terms. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because some of the work that he did there was pretty important. And he was notably seen as a very, very pro-union guy in the House of Representatives, which was relatively uncommon still at the time. So in his three terms in the U.S. House, serving as a Democrat in a heavily Republican district in Pennsylvania, William B. Wilson was the chairman of the Committee on Labor, the Committee on Mines, and the Committee on Merchant Marines and Fisheries. And for this, I'm looking at an article on the Miller Center website. And the section that Rachel was reading, that was from Wikipedia, but a very, very heavily researched section. Most of the sentences there had somewhere between 3 and 7 citations on each one, which were citations to various other books. So it was a well-written section that I figured we would borrow for this. As always, you can go to arsenalfordemocracy.com with each episode to look up our PDF where we upload all of the notes and sources for everything. So getting back into this Miller Center article. So when Wilson was 30, he back in 1892, he had first run for Congress unsuccessfully, but he was 44 when he was successfully elected in 1906. However, he lost his seat in the 1912 election, but his work was not done even then. He had authored an act of Congress to try to separate out the a new labor department out of the Commerce Department. This was something that was basically the last thing that President Taft signed on his way out the door on Inauguration Day, although he apparently, according to the Social Welfare Library at VCU, he was not necessarily happy about signing William B. Wilson's legislation. But he did so. This created a labor department, and this meant that Woodrow Wilson needed a new labor secretary. So he picked this recently out-of-work Democratic congressman who had just lost his seat a few months earlier and was widely seen as a, you know, relatively moderate union figure, but a guy with extensive, you know, ties to organized labor and so forth, who could be an influential and positive force as the first U.S. labor secretary. In his first annual report, according to the article at the Social Welfare Library at Virginia Commonwealth University website, Secretary William B. Wilson enunciated a philosophy echoed by many secretaries since, that the department was created in the interest of the wage earners, but must be administered in fairness to labor, business, and the public at large. Under Wilson's early leadership, the bureaus functioned fairly autonomously, and the department focused most of its remaining resources on the new USCS, the U.S. Conciliation Service, which was for mediating labor strikes and things like that. Secretary Wilson also set up a national employment service within the Bureau of Immigration, which at the time was placed under the Labor Department because of the close relationship between immigration and labor issues. Now, just as a side tangent here, something that we talked about on the show, I want to say back in like 2015, so probably at least 5, maybe even 6 years ago now, was about the Woodrow Wilson administration's approach to labor politics, which they tried to implement on the world in much the same way that they did with the Peace of Versailles and the League of Nations and stuff like that after World War I. in terms of this, and this was supposed to be this new approach in the interwar period, or as they were hoping at the time, the post-war for all time period, of like trying to balance the interests of labor and business and having government serve as this like mediating third force. So you can see that Woodrow Wilson and William B. Wilson seemed relatively aligned on this particular point. At the time, under Woodrow Wilson's administration, in this first period of the labor secretaryship of William B. Wilson, there were about 2,000 Department of Labor employees, and there were four bureaus, and this is according to a Department of Labor history article on him. The four bureaus were Children, Immigration, Naturalization, and Labor Statistics. There was also, as we just said, the Division of Conciliation that was to try to mediate certain labor disputes. And then, of course, with World War I, the Labor Department took on an important role as well. And the Department of Labor says that Secretary Wilson put the Department of Labor on the map. However, it's important to understand that a lot of his work happened before World War I. Many of the current Department of Labor activities, except the regulatory work that later became so important, I think, under the New Deal, trace back to that period. Employment services, employment of women, fair employment for minorities, labor management relations. And the Department of Labor obviously also did work to mobilize resources in the workforce for defense production, as we'll talk about in a bit. But first, I want to talk about one of the major projects of both Congress and the Labor Department before World War I. So, Rachel, could you get us back onto that topic of child labor that you touched on earlier, because this was clearly a cause that was of importance to Secretary Wilson. So let's talk about the Keating-Owen Child Labor Act of 1916.
So during Wilson's time as Labor Secretary, Congress passed the Keating-Owen Child Labor Act of 1916. This massively restricted the use of children as workers for companies doing interstate commerce, which was to have established the Labor Department's authority to make surprise inspections of mines and factories and other work sites. But the Supreme Court did strike it down 5-4 within a year. This was part of the Lochner era, where the Supreme Court struck down a lot of regulatory activities at that time. So had the law survived, it would have banned interstate sale of goods by companies employing children at night or for more than 8 hours of the day, or employing children under 14, or in the case of mines, children under 16. As we said earlier, William Wilson had been a 12-year-old mine worker when he became a union organizer. Public pressure campaigns, compulsory education laws, and technological capital investment ended up mostly eliminating breaker boys from mines by the end of the Woodrow Wilson years anyway. So it became less of an issue that it did get struck down.
So in mid-1917, that law was struck down. But at that point, the department was already preoccupied with the entry of the United States into World War I. And that is probably a key reason why they didn't try to pick back up on that or come up with some workaround for the Supreme Court decision. According to the Social Welfare Library article at VCU, the Department of Labor assumed the major responsibility for implementing the nation's war labor policies, which included the recognition of the right of workers to bargain collectively. This was basically a concession to create labor peace during the war. There was also the establishment of machinery to adjust grievances and an 8-hour workday. The War Labor Administration, headed by William B. Wilson under Woodrow Wilson, was placed in charge of most of the government's labor programs. Its principal component was the War Labor Board, which adjudicated disputes that were not resolved by that new USCS conciliation system. When the war ended, however, an upsurge in labor management conflict resulted in an alarming strike wave that threatened to paralyze the rebounding post-war economy. At the same time, a nationwide Red Scare led to a series of government raids resulting in the arrests of thousands of dangerous aliens. The Justice Department demanded that the Bureau of Immigration, under the Labor Department, deport them all, but the Department of Labor under William Wilson insisted on observing strict legal standards, and it dismissed most of the charges. 556 proven communists, however, were deported. And that brings us back to 1919 and what we talked about on our episode a couple of weeks ago with regard to the strike in the coal industry and the steel industry. And we talked at the time about how the labor secretary clashed significantly with Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and his interpretation. He was relatively hostile to labor, and we did allude to the fact that there was disagreement between him and the labor secretary, who had this background with the not only unions broadly, but specifically the United Mine Workers of America. We speculated on that episode that Woodrow Wilson probably did not, as president, have a whole lot to do with resolving the coal strike in 1919, and we were trying to figure out who might have, given that Wilson was mostly incapacitated by a stroke for much of that strike period. And my guess is that probably William Wilson, the labor secretary, had a good deal to do with that. Palmer, however, is an interesting figure because, in contrast with William B. Wilson, who you might have noticed, we said took office at the beginning of the creation of the Labor Department at the beginning of 1913, after he lost his seat in Congress, and then he's still around for when we get to 1919, which is relatively unusual. That's because he had been there and ended up serving for the entirety of the 8 years of the Woodrow Wilson administration. This contrasts, however, with the new Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, who was new in 1919. He succeeded Thomas Watt Gregory, who had been there for the rest of the administration. And Gregory, who we might talk about, I think, on a another episode at some point in the future, tried to suppress domestic opposition to the war and was doing like mass arrests of draft resistors and things like that, and hunting down people for alleged pro-German sentiments. But then he was replaced by Palmer, who, of course, would go on to do the Palmer raids after the 1919 strikes at the beginning of 1920. His sort of central antagonist during the power vacuum of Woodrow Wilson being incapacitated by a stroke, you had this clash between various cabinet members trying to assert who was or was not in authority, and Palmer trying to make claims to the public saying that everyone in the cabinet was agreeing with his decisions, and William B. Wilson, the labor secretary, was brave enough to say, actually, I don't agree with these, and we didn't decide this unanimously. And so he essentially stood up for labor to the best that he could in 1919, when, according to the Labor Department statistics at the time, there were 3,374 strikes in that 1 year alone, which we've talked about numerous times on the show in the past several months about those specific post-World War I strikes. So, as I said, William B. Wilson was in office as labor secretary for 8 years, which is, you know, relatively unusual, although, as we'll see in just a second, not for this department. But those 8 years were really pivotal in terms of setting the direction and tone of the department. And, you know, that's why the phrase you hear a lot is that he put his stamp on the Department of Labor. And that was really important. However, a lot of his work was undermined pretty significantly by the fact that he was succeeded by, and we might have to do an episode on him at some point because I don't think we have yet, the truly awful James J. Davis, who actually served for almost 11 years under three different Republican presidents. And he, of course, being the second labor secretary and serving for an even longer tenure, really also significantly shaped the Department of Labor in some unfortunate ways. The department didn't return to pro-labor hands until Frances Perkins took office at the beginning of FDR's tenure in 1933, and she would serve for the entirety of his tenure until he had passed away in 1945. So then what happened, though, after Woodrow Wilson left office as president and William B. Wilson left office with him? As we had said, he had, you know, tried to be in Congress multiple points in his career and had served in the House for three terms. Well, he decided that he wanted to go run for Senate in Pennsylvania. So, Rachel, could you talk about the sort of strange end of William B. Wilson's political career before he retired permanently?
Yeah. So, like you said, he tried to run for U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania as a Democrat in the 1926 midterm election. His Republican opponent, Congressman William Scott Vare, tried pretty blatantly to steal the election. Both the primaries and general election were mired in scandal. He apparently won the election against William B. Wilson by trying to steal it, However, Governor Gifford Pinchot, who had been beaten by Vere in the primary and was pretty salty about it, refused to certify the election. In January 1927, Pinchot testified before the Senate, and he produced several thousand illegal paper ballots. William B. Wilson alleged that voter fraud in the election included padded registration lists, phantom voters, and voter intimidation. As this went on, the U.S. Senate refused to seat the opponent, so ultimately, 3 years later, the seat was simply declared vacant and eligible for appointment by the next Republican governor. So this was a very unusual end to William B. Wilson's career, unfortunately mired in scandal, and he didn't win what could have been probably a valid Senate election.
So that covers it for our summary of William B. Wilson, no relation to President Woodrow Wilson, under whom he served for 8 years as labor secretary, setting a relatively pro-labor course for the department as a former top union leader and longtime organizer since childhood in the mines. William B. Wilson, I thought an interesting figure to discuss. And Rachel, since we have a few extra minutes here before the end of the episode, let's just talk a little bit more to our listeners about what is coming up in January. As we said in previous episodes, we are going to be leaving WVUD at the end of December. We've got a few more episodes, really great episodes coming up in December before we conclude our time at WVUD, where we've been where I've been with the show since 2011. But this is the kind of episode I think that we're going to be seeing a lot more of on the show. Some of them might be relatively short like this one. Some of them might, a lot of them we're expecting will probably be around, you know, 37, 40 minutes or so. And maybe we'll have some double length episodes for particularly detailed topics or detailed interviews around, you know, an hour and 15 minutes in length, something like that. But Rachel, what should we let listeners know about in terms of what they can kind of expect from some of the podcast only episodes that we'll be doing in January?
Well, like you said, I think we're going to kind of lean into the varied length of episodes. I think that's one of my favorite parts of podcast listening. Sometimes you get into those really deep dives, and sometimes you just kind of get a quick taste of a topic. We will be putting out two episodes a week, one for bonus members only, and we will be, for the first month or so, be providing two episodes a week for free, just to give you a taste. I think there's been talks about what else we can provide to just make the experience really worth it. Oh, and also, I think by having this opportunity to provide more detailed and maybe expanded length episodes, we can bring back more co-hosts and have some of those like three member episodes that we kind of had during our hour-long episodes, but it's just really hard to fit three people into a short half-hour episode. So you'll get to hear from some old favorites again.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we're still figuring out a lot of the details of exactly what we want to be doing in January, but I will say that before we recorded this episode, Rachel and I were looking ahead, and even setting aside the episodes that are coming up in December before we go to the podcast-only format, we have already planned 21 episodes for a significant portion of the year in 2021. And so we are really excited for what's coming up. You know, the show has evolved a lot over the years. It did start as more of a news of the week type of show, and we've kind of, you know, done a lot of that stuff for much of its run. But, you know, in 2015 with Kelly, who came back on this summer, we did a lot of what we called big ideas for reforming American governance. And these were, you know, ideas for like if you had another Reconstruction period and you added a whole bunch of constitutional amendments and things like that, what would some of those include? And we talked about things like right to housing and right to nutrition and things like that. And that was a really kind of exciting, interesting period for the show. And then we had to go on hiatus because that was the first time that I was running for office as a candidate. And one of the reasons that we're basically deciding that we're going to leave the radio station is nothing against the radio station, but more about the fact that the podcast gives us more freedom when I'm up for re-election and so forth for my local city council position and so forth, that we don't have to go off the air every time I'm up for election. we can deliver a more even and consistent product and so forth. And that's really exciting for us. But it's also going to allow us, as Rachel said, to do these varied episode lengths that are more appropriate to a specific topic. And we are really excited about that and definitely getting more guest interviews on and so forth. But today's episode and the past however many episodes are a pretty good indication of where we're going with this. We've done a lot of history-related episodes, usually with some sort of modern-day hook or connection, but we've done a lot of these history episodes over the past almost 2 years at this point, and people seem to be responding really well. We've really enjoyed doing it. I think we feel like we've learned a lot just putting these episodes together and putting all these notes together for each week. And we've been producing like a lot of really detailed notes with each of these episodes, including in a lot of cases, things that we didn't get to talk about for time reasons. But we are really excited as well to be able to have those, you know, three or four people on an episode instead of just the two of us by having more flexibility on the time format and so forth. And so we're definitely really looking forward to that part. As I said, there's still certain elements to be worked out on the exact details of what we're going to be doing, but we definitely hope people will stick around for, you know, Arsenal for Democracy, which will essentially be delivering you a casual material history of the United States. You know, this is never going to be a super, super heavily researched you know, academic history podcast, but we're trying to sort of provide a popular history and overview of ideas for things to that people might get more interested in looking up more on their own about. And we want people to have a better understanding from a left-wing perspective of the history of the United States and in some cases, the rest of the Americas as well, because there's usually something that ties it back to the United States. So Rachel, I'm really looking forward to this new phase of the show, but thank you so much for being on this week to talk about Labor Secretary William B. Wilson.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.